This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Today we have a guest with us who has played a quiet but very important and very special role in things like the Mars Face Project and a really serious look into what our real history has been, dating back to way before the oldest civilizations that we have any record of. Mark Carlotto has been for over 40 years involved in space-related applications involving remote sensing, mapping, image processing, pattern recognition, machine learning, and related technologies. He has a PhD in electrical engineering from Carnegie Mellon. He has written over 100 technical and scientific papers, 9 books. He was an adjunct professor at Boston University in the 80s, and he taught courses in computer architecture, image processing. He has been on quite a journey as an independent scientist, which he and I have a lot to talk about, because he was involved in the original imaging of the Mars face before NASA made it. Well, we'll talk about it in a few minutes. Ann and I financed the initial work that he did, and out of it came his book, The Martian Enigmas. And we're going to talk about the truth about this, because this truth has been completely, brilliantly, and terrifyingly covered up. Mark Carlotto, welcome to Dreamland.
Willie, thanks very much.
Well, it's such an extraordinary pleasure to see you again. We were talking just before we started, folks, and Mark and I have not seen each other since we were together at Bruce Maccabee's house. It must have been in the late 80s or early 90s.
I think so. And it was, I think it was after, soon after the book Communion came out, around that time, I think.
Yeah. You know, I'm trying to remember who introduced, and I think I do remember who introduced me to you. It was a space scientist who was, he was going to be the first Mars astronaut until...
Brian O'Leary.
Brian O'Leary, that's right. Yeah. Brian O'Leary, until he discovered that they planned to send him alone. And he thought, maybe this mission isn't going to work, which might have been correct. And he pulled out. Dick Hoagland introduced me to the Mars face. And I began to want to do some serious imaging on that. And that's how you came into my life. And I think it was through Brian. And then...
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Yeah, we worked together. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, Brian's PhD actually was in the optical properties of Mars. And so what I was working on at the time was a method for computing 3D models from images. Stuff that's, more routine nowadays. But, having a knowledge of the surface and the physics, how, light reflects off of Mars was important. So we worked together on a couple of papers. One of the papers was published in Applied Optics that showed that phase wasn't a trick of light and shadow, as NASA had been saying repeatedly. So we showed that that was not the case. We worked together for a number of years.
Now, let's cut to the second image that they took, the closer image. I remember emailing you about that image because it looked like the ground form had been disturbed. What happened there? Why does the second image look just like a pile of rocks, basically? The closer image
What happened was... This was many years later, when they finally got around to reimaging it, and they took the first opportunity and it was in the wintertime on Mars, and the sun was at a low angle, and it was almost like, you know, if you hold a flashlight under your face and you light your face that way, it looks spooky. But you know, with the face on Mars being a formation, it had a lot of unusual characteristics, and it wasn't immediately obvious what it was. And so because of that, you know, NASA said, well, this is just, you know, obviously it's just a pile of rocks, and they finally did bury it at that point. You know, I analyzed that picture in some detail, and I tried to get the work published, but the community was not, even the alternative science community was not even willing to accept it at that point. It was like, NASA did a really good job of burying it.
I'm going to have a man on Dreamland in January, I think, who has gathered hundreds and hundreds of images from Mars and the Moon that NASA has airbrushed. Hundreds of them. In other words, they make sure that we don't see certain things on the Moon and Mars. Why is that, do you think?
Well, you know, get a chance to talk about my more recent work. This is really a common theme, Whitley, that, you know, scientists and academics like to keep things in the box. They don't like to explore new possibilities because they're interesting. Only when push comes to shove are they willing to do. And generally, it's when there's so many anomalies, so many situations that sort of come about and break the rules, that they're willing to, you know, change the paradigm. And so when there's a few cases, they tend to sort of marginalize them. It's really a very common behavior. I just recently had another paper. I was trying to publish a paper. I'm still trying to publish a paper on a buried structure in Egypt. And there's very good evidence suggesting that it's there. It's called the Labyrinth. And Herodotus talked about it, you know, 500 BCE. It was, he said it was more grand than the pyramids, but it threatens, you know, mainstream Egyptology. And, you know, this is, again, it's another, you know, we started talking about Mars, but it's a theme that actually runs through anything that pushes the boundaries of science.
Well, what happens is they fall into the trap of defending their beliefs rather than doing research.
That's right.
And that's where Egyptology is, I think it's failed. I think Egyptology is a failed science, frankly.
They're trying.
I just can't be able to describe it.
I think so, because they've already defined the ground rules. It's like there was really nothing before the Egyptians other than, you know, primitive people. They kind of dismissed the dynastic, you know, evidence of earlier civilizations that, you know, I believe were really the ones responsible for at least the original structures at Giza and perhaps even the Labyrinth. But, you know, once you decide what the ground rules are, then it becomes more political than scientific.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. These are very fine, beautifully educated and sincere people, but they have drifted into the same trap that the pre-Galileo, or the, I should say, yeah, well, that science as it was, as insofar as it existed then, had drifted into before Galileo and Copernicus and people like that came along.
Yes. Yeah.
So it's too bad. It really is, because we need them more than ever now. We need to know what really happened. And, you know, before Atlantis, and Beyond Atlantis, the two books you've written on Atlantis are quite amazing. I have to admit, sadly enough, I don't have much information on Beyond Atlantis, but I have read before Atlantis very carefully and in detail. Let's go to one of the most extraordinary things in Before Atlantis is the long lists of sites that point to directions other than true north. And there are large numbers of them grouped together, all pointing at a direction that no longer has any meaning. Can you tell us a little bit about what that's about?
Yeah, I mean, if you give me a few extra minutes, I can give you the, how it all started.
Sure.
I wasn't really looking for anything important or significant. I was looking at Google Earth. We're going to Mexico on vacation, and I wanted to visit some of the sites. So, I'm looking at Chichen Itza and other places. And it's like, why aren't they aligned to north? And I hadn't really, thought about any of this stuff before. And it wasn't just a few sites. Not very, very little in Mexico is aligned to the cardinal directions. And I thought, well, okay, maybe it's aligned to solstices, to the moon in different ways. And it turned out that none of those cases were the case. And so I remembered this idea of pole shifts that Charles Hapgood had proposed back in the 50s. Because it actually came up in the Mars investigation. Do you remember Tom Van Flandern? He was an astronomer that was involved with the Mars research. He actually proposed that there's very good evidence that Mars poles have shifted significantly. It was because when the Tharsis volcano, as that built up, it was such an imbalance on the crust, such mass there that the moments of inertia shifted. Anyway, prior to that, he argued and showed, the data isn't very good, but showed that the face and the city were aligned in the cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west. Dick Hoagland, showed that it could have been aligned to a solstice back, half, was it 250,000, I forget, 250,000 years ago, something like that. In any case, the whole idea of pole shifts kind of got started on Mars, and I remembered this. And it's like, I wonder if any of these sites in Mexico pointed to previous poles. I got Hapgood's book, and he had found a few positions. And sure enough, like Teotihuacan, north of Mexico City, lines up perfectly to the Hudson Bay pole. This was the pole supposedly before the current pole existed. And so this got me going. And I became a bit of a lunatic with Google Earth. I didn't have any automatic software, but I'm drawing lines from, with the ruler tool from an object all the way up to these poles. And it's like, I'm up like all night doing this. And I find tons of sites. Anyway, that's how the research got started. And later on, I actually did a systematic study. I've done several. And the evidence is... It's interesting, and I don't know why archaeoastronomers don't, haven't talked about this, but most of these sites are not aligned in any known ways. But when you bring in other poles, almost all of them can be explained. And so this was kind of like my epiphany.
And in the book, for example, I'm just looking at sites aligned to the Norwegian Sea Pole. There's a whole huge list of them. Abydin in Israel, Dendera, Edfu, Como Omo in Egypt, Shunet, Tulum in Mexico, Uxmal, Templo Major in Mexico, it's Chan Chan in Peru, Hatusa in Turkey, all over the world, all aligned. And you can tell when these probably were built by figuring out when the pole might have been there when they were built. Is that correct?
So what I was sort of working on at the time was just sort of the geometry or the geography, I should say. If you put a pole in different positions, how many sites does that explain? And I was actually able to refine Hapgood's original polls. He had come up with three previous ones. I found four. And with those four, I could account for pretty much all the sites. I did not have a dating for them, though. Hapgood had dated using climate data. Then someone contacted me, and this is why, you know, the internet and just, you know, modern tech is so great, because you can work with people anywhere in the world, and they find you, and if you have, you know, rapport, common interests, you work together. Anyway, he had a background in environmental science, and he showed that he actually came up with some data. I'm sorry, I'm a little distracted. My grandkids are here, and they're running wild through the house.
That's okay. That's okay. We, some of us also have grandkids, so.
Okay. I'm going to try to ignore it. Anyway, what he was able to research were papers that had been written finding it was a fossil data, seemingly a plate fossil data showing like in these bone caves in the United Kingdom, some caves actually had evidence of animals that lived in subtropical or tropical climates, like rhinoceros and hyenas, you know, more arid climates. And then other caves had evidence of like the Arctic fox and the, you know, mammoth and other animals that are more cold weather. And anyway, you know, the United Kingdom is not a large area, but in these different caves, it showed just a tremendous diversity of fossils from, you know, different climate zones. Using this information, his name is Mark Gaffney. He actually came up with the original dating for these poles, which actually corresponded quite nicely with Hapgood's. Again, I found an extra one. You know, based on that, we had a chronology. And that chronology takes us back to about 130,000 years ago, where the oldest pole that we've analyzed existed, that was in the Bering Sea, north of the Aleutian Islands. And then it shifted from there to northern Greenland. From there, it shifted to, mentioned, the Norwegian Sea. From there to Hudson Bay, and from there to the Arctic. So we had a chronology, we had the geography, and now we could, you know, come up with some new datings for these sites. And they were, you know, much older than archaeologists, you know, accept. And I was at a conference presenting this information, and someone said to me, you know, your presentation was really interesting. You presented a lot of data, but you lost your audience once you started talking about the dates. I says, well, what do you mean? He said, well, what you should do is you should change your theory to make the dates more in line with what we already know. And I said, okay, thank you very much. And, you know, that's probably the last time I'll speak to that group. But, you know, this is typical. You have people that think in terms of the box. You present them with data. You can't argue with a statistic, so you argue, you know, you dispute the interpretation of it. So this is ongoing right now with me.
There's a disconnect. Well, let me give you an example. What is the date of the Norwegian Sea pole?
So the Norwegian Sea pole was about 75,000 years ago. So at that point, let me give you a little context. Have you heard of this enormous supervolcanic eruption called Toba, T-O-B-A?
Maybe I have and maybe I haven't, but I'll bet you not many of my audiences have. So why don't you tell us about it?
So this is like a VEI-8 event, tremendously powerful, the most powerful eruption on Earth in the last 100+ thousand years. It was considered an extinction event where you know, many species either died out or almost died out, including humanity. And the timing of this coincides with the Norwegian Sea pole, with what we believe was a pole shift from Greenland to the Norwegian Sea. And there were other things that happened. There were geomagnetic disturbances, like kind of like what we're seeing now. And in fact, it was something called an excursion where the pole where the magnetic field collapses and could possibly even, excuse me, could reverse itself. And this, and then following this, there were eruptions and major cataclysmic events, and we believe the pole shift. So this was at a time when evidently human populations were decimated, yet at some point after that, we're finding sites in certain parts of the world that were built in alignment to that pole. And you mentioned some of them.
Yes.
It actually turns out that the number of sites that I've been able to find draw precipitously at this point after this eruption during this period of time, and then later on increased again, which is very interesting. Again, it's circumstantially corroborating that.
We're recovering.
Yeah, yeah. So,
Here's the thing that, when I talk to conventional archaeologists about ideas like this, they say 75,000 years ago, there is no evidence of any habitations that would support the kind of populations needed to create the temples and so forth that these people, as they call you, and they call me these people too, on a different level. In any case, are claiming were there. In other words, the people and the places that they needed to live in didn't exist and didn't happen. The people were very primitive. So how could these sophisticated sites have been built?
Yeah, then again, lack of evidence doesn't necessarily mean. How does it go? Doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. It just means that you haven't found it yet. Now, they'll roll their eyes with that. It's a little tricky because you don't have all the answers. So you're dealing with, incomplete information, but the information that you do have, on the other hand, can't be explained by these same archaeologists using any conventional theory, because it's like how the primitive Stone Age people all of a sudden within a few thousand years start erecting structures like the Giza pyramids. Where's the evolution in the technology? What happens in Egypt, as is that the most sophisticated structures are the oldest, and then it declines, it decreases, which is counterintuitive to how anthropology says, humankind has developed. We've gotten, increasingly more sophisticated. Yet there appears to be these dips. So maybe there's dips, there's rises and falls. And that's really the whole idea behind my book, Before Atlantis, is that there's been a series of them, four of them, in fact, over the last 100,000 years.
We're going to take a little break right now, and we will be right back. We're talking to Mark Carlotto. His website, markcarlotto.com. We are talking about his book, Before Atlantis, but go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and you will find Mark has written many books. And the absolutely seminal book on Mars, the Mars face. And so it's an extraordinary output. It really is. When the poles shift, what's the difference between the pole shift as you conceive of them and Hapgood conceived of them and polar wander, which is an established scientific geological fact?
Yeah, that's a great question. So plate tectonics is based on the idea that the Earth's crust is divided into these plates that sort of move independently. And based on the science that has verified that to be the case, it's basically, paleomagnetic data, magnetic field recorded in volcanic rock that hardens and when it hardens, the direction of the magnetic field at the time is sort of frozen. using this information, they can piece all this together and figure out how the continents have wandered and so forth over time. And it shows that there are systematic shifts in the crust that occur over a very long period of time. What Hapgood proposed was that instead of this happening, you know, plate tectonics and actually plate tectonic theory hadn't even been formally accepted in Hapgood's time. But he felt, based on, again, not geological information so much, but climate data, that it appeared that different parts of the world suddenly entered and left, you know, polar climates. And so, you know, this corresponds with the movement of ice sheets and so forth that have been mapped. So he, based on sort of the climate data, he proposed that there's got to be something else going on. So it wasn't a geological argument. So, and this is kind of the tricky part, because it's not a geological argument, or the motivation wasn't, but it is geology. It's like, okay, so, you know, how do you explain it? He proposed that it was a buildup of ice that caused the, you know, the moment of inertia of the Earth's crust to change, sort of like on Mars, but with the Tharsis, the volcano that caused, you know, Mars poles to shift. This is accepted. It's not accepted that Earth's poles shift in the way that had described it. So, what you know he proposed was that it was a build of ice. Albert Einstein actually, who was alive at the time, he analyzed Hapgood's work and he said, "Yeah, I don't think there's enough mass up there to cause this to happen." I actually did an analysis, part of a paper I published a few years ago, where I come up with a new version of Hapgood's theory based on some other mechanisms. And I actually show that the amount of ice that we think was present at the last glacial max would have moved the pole only, you know, just a short distance based on changes in the moment of inertia. But what I came up with, and it's, you know, it's speculative and it's tentative, is another way this could work. And that is that we talk about these geomagnetic changes where, you know, experiencing now where the compass calibration, you know, north, true north to magnetic north has to be updated, you know, fairly regularly because the magnetic pole is moving. Evidently this occurs or can occur preceding what are called geomagnetic excursions where the magnetic field will start to break down, weaken. Poles, the actual poles sort of, they don't maintain their integrity and the field collapses. And in some cases, there's evidence that it actually reverses itself. So the north magnetic pole becomes the south and vice versa. So the theory that I proposed was that when this occurs, if the field reverses, then the magnetism of the crust is opposite that of the core. And that could cause the crust to become unlocked. So whereas, you know, the crust is sort of floating on the mantle, which is, you know, molten, and there's obviously movement because it's, you know, the plates are moving. But this becomes much more freely moving when the field reverses. And when this occurs, tidal forces of the sun and the moon, primarily the moon, could over a period of time cause the crust to move. Same way that the moon moves the Earth's oceans, it would move more slowly, but decidedly would move the Earth's crust. And so this is the mechanism I actually proposed. Sorry, that's
fabulous. But I just have a question I want to kick in here.
Yeah.
The crust moves, wouldn't we see a lot of disruption on the surface, earthquakes and even mountain ranges changing form and so forth? That I don't think we see that.
Well, so this doesn't normally happen, and it hasn't happened yet. But I believe there's been four episodes over the last 130,000 years where it did happen, and there was a crustal shift. And one of these times was during the time of the Toba eruption, 75,000 years ago, the Norwegian Sea Pole. And there's been other eruptions that have taken place and other geomagnetic reversals. And I don't have them committed to memory. I can, you know, I'm Italian. I can use my hands just so much, but I need charts and I don't have any charts right now. It's all, all right. The point is it's all in the book. And what's interesting is that there are things that seem to occur around the same time. Geomagnetic anomalies, volcanic eruptions, and what appear to be pole shifts. And these are correlated with changes in the global sea levels, which relates to the amount of, inversely related to the amount of ice at the poles. So as ice at the poles melt, global sea levels rise. And this happens at when the poles shift because,
Well, that's happening right now.
It's happening now largely because of the increase in carbon dioxide. But during the last glacial max, the hypothesis, Hapke's hypothesis was that the Earth, that the North Pole, the geomagnetic pole, it's not in the Arctic, but it was in Hudson Bay in Canada. And because of that, all of us here on the East Coast, we're under a mile of ice. Why? Because we're in the polar zone. We weren't, it's the polar zone wasn't the Arctic Circle any, at that time it was a region centered in Hudson Bay. And so what happened was when the hypothesis is that when the poles shifted, Northern Canada was shifted from the polar zone to the temperate zone. And that's why all the ice melted. I mean, there's ice in Northern Canada, but you know, where I live here in the Boston area, we're under a mile of ice that, you know, that began melting 20,000 years ago. Why? Again, the most logical reason is not that the Earth's climate as a whole warmed by, they said, you know, 10 degrees or so, but because this part of the world was shifted out of the polar zone into the temperate zone. And anyway, I apologize. I'm covering kind of a lot of ground and not necessarily the most logical way, but
that's the point.
Is that there are a series of cataclysms that occurred. You know, Plato's Atlantis is perhaps one case that, you know, came down to us through oral tradition, and there's others, Maori flood tradition and stories in New Zealand and in the South Pacific, and there's flood myths and of course the Sumerians and Zoroastrians have their own flood myths, and so
they do.
Anyway, these are all connected. They're all connected. We have basically
another little break right here, so we're going to take a break. We'll be right back. You know, what you're talking about right now, and we're talking to Mark Carlotto, his books Before Atlantis and many others. Go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and just search on Mark Carlotto, and you're going to find a treasure trove of extraordinary work. This is a brilliant man and an excellent writer. I could not put Before Atlantis down. It's my Kindle is filled with notes and things, and you can see every few pages you got that all that yellow stuff. This is me taking notes. Now,
very kind, thank you.
And you can meet him at markcarlotto.com as well, and get into his work. And it's uniquely well organized and very well thought out work, and a departure from the conventional wisdom for sure. And yeah. Mark is a very, very well put together rebel, a little bit like Graham Hancock in that respect. Now we're in a situation right now. I mean, we're seeing the magnetic poles moving. We are seeing the sea levels rise. So what's in store for us now?
So, you know, there's a lot of charts in my books, and one of the charts shows the global sea level changes over the last 100,000 years, and I think I have another one that shows it over the last 200,000 years. And they're kind of like, they're very similar. I mean, you've heard the expression that history doesn't repeat, it rhymes, right?
Yes.
It's sort of like there's a certain pattern or periodicity in the way the global sea levels change. And again, that's related to the amount of polar ice. So over the last 100,000 years, the sea levels were much lower because there was much more ice. And then, you know, 20,000 years ago, it melted. You go back 200,000 years, you have sort of the same pattern. There's no reason to think it's not going to repeat again. And so, you know, we could be, even though we're, you know, facing global warming, if the poles shifted and, you know, we were suddenly thrust into the, back into the polar zone, you know, there'd be, again, formation of glaciers in Massachusetts here where I live. You know, so anyway, it's the relevance is that this is not something that has happened in the past and it may not happen again in the future. I think based on the cycles, and I'm a believer in cycles going back to, you know, ancient Vedic traditions. We talk about, you know, universal cycles. You know, I think it's, you know, bound to repeat again, particularly now with the geomagnetic anomalies that are occurring. But I mean, someone once asked me, you know, is it like next year or next couple of years? I said it could be in the next 1,000 years, but you know, who knows? I'm sure we won't be here. There are other things that we worry about more these days than pole shifts.
Well, absolutely, we sure do, and with good reason, because I think pole shifts are a bit of an outlier. Now that I say that, we'll probably have one tonight, but. In any case, you know, wake up in the morning, suddenly it's all cold, and then the sun goes past in the sky over about a 10-minute period, and you know you're in trouble of some kind.
Yeah, something's happened.
Yeah. Something's right. happening. You know, I remember back in the old days when there was nothing but internet relay chat. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Remember the conversation that went on about Mars and that incredible post by one of the members of that chat group. I forgot his name. It's been too long.
John Brandenburg, maybe.
Or no, it wasn't John, but it could have been easily. And it was it started out Mars was murdered.
That's John. Remember? Yeah,
it was John. Wasn't it? Yeah, I've had John on the show, and he's, you know, he's. He's certain, and what's so fascinating is he has reason to be sure that there was a or something happened on Mars that left a
nuclear
large
event.
Area.
Yeah, yeah, a nuclear event. Yeah. John. You know, John and I work together quite a bit. Different disciplines, but he, you know, again, sort of common interest in these anomalies. And, you know, it's like, well, what happened to them? And his theory is that there was a nuclear event. Was it a bomb? I don't know. I mean, I don't think anyone really knows, but it was vast and it was over the northern hemisphere. You know, and I think his hypothesis is that it kind of blew the atmosphere away. That was it. That was the end.
You know, I want to tell you a story, and some of my listeners have heard this story before, but it's definitely going to creep you out. We got a lot of letters, and I'm not sure that this letter is anywhere in our files anymore, but it could be. It was from a lady in Tennessee who was out walking in the woods with her son, and suddenly a little man, as she put it, came out of a cave and said he was a rebel and he wanted to tell her the truth. And the truth is, he said, there was a war between Earth and Mars many, many thousands of years ago, and we destroyed Mars's atmosphere and the surface of Mars. But they won the war because they captured our souls, and they will never let us die and never let us escape. We are prisoners here and condemned to always, after the body dies, to recur in another body and never leave this place. And he said, in our language, Our name for Earth is Dead Forever.
Hmm.
Now, if that is not scary, and if you...
That's a little dark.
I don't know what it is.
That actually takes my mind off of Election Day. That's pretty dark.
Yeah. Oh, folks, we're recording this on Election Day, and, you know, I'm pretty sanguine about elections. Whatever happens, happens in my... I'm very oriented toward the visitors, and, you know, they have their issues, and their issues are the danger of nuclear war and climate change. And the rest of it, you know, I don't think about it. I know the Trump and Harris are running, but by the time you see this, you'll know who's president, or will it be in some kind of a revolution that I'll just keep out of the way, like I always have all my life. Okay, but let's go on with the story, because what if that story is true? And you know, if you look back into the Vedas and the Bhagavad Gita, you do see a lot of stuff about wars in space. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, as allegory, that also I think has some relevance to, you know, what they talk about in the Gita and the other, you know, other Vedic texts is, you know, this idea that we're in this cycle of life and death. And, you know, it's our karma. If our karma is good, we come back and we're rewarded. If not, we're punished. But there's really no way to escape this. There actually are ways, but it's more in esoteric traditions. But that, you know, resonates, I think, with, you know, with the story that you just, or this person told about, you know, Earth and Mars. So, yeah, I never heard that one. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Well, no one's ever heard it, because she just sent it in a letter to me and Anne. And, you know, I've quoted it a number of times. And I don't know if it's in the archive at Rice University of our letters, because they haven't all been digitized yet. So we'll find it if it exists. But it was very telling, and especially because of the fact that it came in. We had this discussion on Internet Relay Chat about Mars being murdered. And, you know, and there's Dick Hoagland points out that there's something struck the base of the D&M pyramid in Sidonia and collapsed the pyramid from within. And, you know, if this is true, of course, if we do send people to Mars and NASA has anything to do with it, if that's true, we won't find out. Which gets me to another question. Why do they do this? I mean, what's the point of... If there's obviously something on Mars they don't want us to see, and the moon, or they wouldn't be airbrushing things. And there's airbrushed a lot of stuff. This man showed me dozens of images that have been airbrushed, not just one or two, but dozens. And what is it about? What are they hiding? You have any idea, Mark?
Do I have any idea?
Why would they hide things on Mars? What
you know? I think, Willie, I think it's sort of like human nature. It's sort of like some people fear they fear the unknown. They fear change. They refuse to accept facts that suggest they're changing. That you need to embrace a new way of looking at things, or whatever. You know, life has changed, but people resist that. And you know, I think scientists are people, and so you have those that are in established positions, and by far this is the majority, and they want to keep things the way it is, because they, you know, it's a safe way of getting, you know, grant money and tenure and so forth, and to make, you know, to study anomalies. So-called anomalistic science is, if you go on Wikipedia, this anomalistic science is the same thing as fake science, pseudoscience. There's absolutely no respect for it in the scientific community. You know, you read Thomas Kuhn, which is the scientific theory of scientific revolution, or I forget the title of it.
Yeah, that's right. That's what it's called.
Something like that. You know, that's at the very foundation of science and how science expands and develops and how we learn. Yet, can you hear all that yelling and screaming? Hopefully not.
No, we can't. Don't worry about it.
Okay. It's just a little distracting to me. Because I'm forgetting about what I'm talking about.
About Thomas Kuhn and his
Kuhn. Yeah. So I think, you know, just coming full circle back to this, I think it's just sort of human nature at work. You know, there are those of us that do not, that are, you know, I won't say we do not fear. We all have some fear, but we're less fearful. We're more curious, and we're more willing to look at things differently for the possibility that maybe we'll learn something new. And, you know, I think this is what it's all about. And, you know, it's a challenge. Could we take a break?
Because our third and final break right now, folks. We're talking to Mark Carlotto. His books, Before Atlantis, and many others, incredibly interesting stuff. Do visit him on Barnes & Noble or Amazon. We'll be right back. We're talking to Mark Carlotto and having quite a journey between wars between Earth and Mars and pole shift and very, very ancient human habitation civilizations. What would they have been like? And, you know, Graham Hancock and I are close friends. We've been friends for many years. And I was in England with him and Santa at their place in Bath, as we call it, a few weeks ago. And then we got together here again in California when they were touring for their new TV series on Netflix. Mm. And we were talking about where was this civilization? And Graham's idea is that, you know, sea levels were at least 400 feet lower than they are now during the Pleistocene, the Ice Age, and they rose really suddenly. And it's extraordinary when the Laurentide ice sheet collapsed. There were fantastic tsunamis all over this planet, and there are geological realities. We can find the traces of the tremendous damage that they did, and this civilization was eradicated. And it was probably a coastal civilization. Why wouldn't it have been? So all we have actually left are what was in the uplands and in the highlands. Mm. Is that a reasonable theory to you? Or do you have, I know Hapgood had a specific place and it was moved, someone who moved it to Antarctica figured out it was probably in Antarctica.
It was Rand Flem Ath wrote a book where he proposed that Antarctica, Atlantis is in Antarctica.
And we're going to find that out, unfortunately, because I think a lot of Antarctica is going to melt in our lifetimes, or in your lifetime anyway. It's hard to believe that I'm nearly 80 years old, but because I don't feel that way at all. And I, you know, like today, I got up at 6, swam for an hour, came back here, had a quick light breakfast. Now I'm talking to you, and do I feel tired? Old? Absolutely not. I'll go on until midnight. I'll get up again at 3 and meditate. And that'll be the way my day is every day. So,
I mean, 80 is the new 60, right?
Well, in my case, I feel it's the new 50.
Even better.
Even better. Exactly.
So you asked about these prior civilizations and, you know, this, you know, we have the fossil record that appears to show, you know, humankind developing, like the archaeologists and anthropologists say, you know, in a very gradual way. And then there's, you know, suddenly things explode, 10,000 BC, Göbekli Tepe and, you know, Eastern and Turkey. And, you know, we're finding, there's, I'm sure, going to be anomalies everywhere. But, you know, how does this happen? What must have been something before that. What I've tried to do in Before Atlantis is rather than try to solve everything, you just sort of kind of bracket it and say, okay, let's leave out the whole extraterrestrial hypothesis. Let's assume that this is just, you know, humans being human. And, you know, Graham Hancock talks about, you know, we're a species with amnesia. Well, it's certainly possible after a cataclysm, any high knowledge, advanced knowledge would have been forgotten because we're going to be more concerned with getting our, you know, our meals and keeping warm and surviving. And over time, you know, this, you know, if it happened now, our, you know, we probably would all die because we can't do anything except go on our mobile devices. So,
yeah, if we lose the satellites, we lose our world. That's how we are very, very fragile because we've become so electronic and so dependent on basically a system of satellites. And, you know, I mean, I get spaceweather.com's alerts every day. The solar max we're in now is way more powerful than anything that anybody imagined it would be. And I think to myself, you know, we've had a 7 X flares, the highest we've had in this solar max so far. But there was a time in 1853 where we had a 45. If we had a 45 now, our civilization would end just like that.
So, you know, I think the possibility that that's happened with, you know, if there was a crustal shift, so meaning the whole skin of the earth moves, causing volcanic eruptions, other kinds of events, floods and so forth. It's not unlikely that evidence of our civilization, which is really just on the surface, would be washed away, would be cut over. You know, in archaeology, the oldest things are the deepest. So maybe if we dig down deep enough, we'll find evidence. But, you know, again, there's got to be sort of a passion to do that. And there's certainly no passion or interest in the archaeological community. They think that it's just a bunch of nonsense. But, you know, I'd love to get that device that Musk developed that, you know, bores holes, to just start going someplace like in Jordan around Baalbek, or is that Lebanon, and just start digging down to see what's under the ancient foundations there, because they have no clue who built those foundations. They're pre-Roman. They're definitely not Roman.
Oh, they're done. They're not Roman. The Romans could move a 60-ton block with their equipment. Not a 1,000-ton block.
Yeah.
Not something that weighed 2 million pounds. Not even close. Let alone cut it, because they didn't have the saws that were.
Yeah.
So, but here, you know, there's so much weird stuff. My God, Baalbek. No foundation between on the causeway between the quarry and the monument and the platform. So with no foundation, that ground is not strong enough. It would have you couldn't have dragged the stones along it long. If they would have become embedded in the earth, but that didn't happen. And yet there's no sign of any foundation on the causeway at all. None. So therefore, they were not moved by being dragged. There was something else that had to have been done.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Yeah.
No, that's okay. I just want to finish my laundry list here. The saws, I've already mentioned that. The causeway, the sheer size of the stones, we couldn't move them now without heavy, heavy equipment. But where is the equipment that they used? Where's any of their tools? Where's any of it?
Right. Let me just, as an aside, let me mention that Baalbek, the Western Wall in Jerusalem, the Parthenon, the Acropolis in Athens, they all are closely aligned with the Greenland Pole. This is the pole that would have existed between 75,000 and 130,000 years ago. So again, these are sites whose alignments cannot be explained. I remember doing a literature search to see, okay, what are the archaeoastronomical sort of theories for Baalbek? There are none. They can't find anything that it was aligned to, but it points to the Greenland Pole. So anyways, so that attests indirectly, circumstantially, to a vast age for these structures, way before, not even the previous civilization, one of the earlier civilizations during the last ice age.
Yeah, you know, exactly. At this end, whatever happened here, I think, excuse me while my iPad falls apart, I think that it was so disruptive and so catastrophic that I agree with Graham and Barbara Hand Clow, and probably you. We are in amnesia. We are literally in a state of amnesia about our own past. We can't look at it because it is so terrifying. And this is somewhere in our genes, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's somewhere in our genes.
Yeah, I mean, it maybe it's somewhat analogous to, you know, if you're a believer in sort of Eastern mysticism, spirituality, you know, the idea that our souls transmigrate the body, you know, our evolution is that of the soul, and body to body, life to life. And, you know, most people, Edgar Cayce might have been an exception, but most of us don't remember our past lives. In the same way, maybe we don't remember, humanity doesn't remember its past ages, in a sort of an analogous
metaphor. I bet you're right.
Yeah.
Listen, we got to say goodbye to our free Dreamlanders, and we're going to keep going on the subscriber side. Subscribers, free Dreamlanders, excuse me. Thank you for being with us. Before Atlantis and many other books, including incredibly cool books on Mars, Mark Carlotto, the original, originally studied the Sidonia face and so forth, a major figure in this field. Don't miss his work. It's quite extraordinary. We'll see you again next week. Okay, Mark, and you know what I would like to do is I would like to go back to, you mentioned this briefly at the beginning of the show, the labyrinth that it's buried. Is it in the Giza Plateau, or what? Tell us about it.
So the labyrinth is in the Fayum, which is, if you can picture the Giza Plateau and the Nile River, the Fayum would be southwest of that in the desert. But it was in ancient times, and even now there's canals and rivers that connect it. It's actually an area that has a lot of agriculture right now. In any case, there was a structure there that actually several structures that Herodotus talks about in his histories. One of which is called Labyrinth. He called the Labyrinth, and he describes it as being much more grander and impressive than even the pyramids. It's like one of the most impressive things he'd ever seen. And this was, this recorded roughly 500 BCE. Flinders Petrie, a British archaeologist, excavated in this area in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And he found evidence of ruins at the surface. And his analysis suggested that, you know, what was left there were really the foundations of an ancient structure. What's transpired since is that research groups, some of it funded by the Egyptian government, dragged sleds with ground penetrating radar. It allows you to basically see through to the subsurface to some depth. And they were able to map what appeared to be indications of rooms and columns and structures below this area. And so what I was able to do a couple of years ago using some space-based radar. So you're familiar with Google Earth. Everyone, you know, is familiar with the imagery you can get on Google Earth, which is visible light images. It's like the same way your camera, your phone works. It's visible light. there are sensors that are in orbit that actually operate at wavelengths that are different, microwaves, for example, microwave wavelengths, called radars or synthetic aperture radars. And one such sensor that was flown by the European Space Agency called Sentinel is actually a ground-penetrating radar. So the wavelength is such that it can actually see into the ground to some distance. And so there's evidence in imagery, and I can give you links to the paper that I've written, trying to get it published, that shows what appears to be an enormous underground structure in this area that's been sort of corroborated by ground truth, by these people pulling these sleds with instruments that look into the ground. And it supports Herodotus's original story about this amazing structure that was above ground, but there was also a below ground part that he was denied access to by the priests. And that's all. So it was sort of, there's something there, but I didn't see it. If this turns out to be real, it's it would be an amazing discovery. But
is there any effort being made to find it, to do archaeology there?
So what they're concerned with now is mainly they think that there's something there, and they're worried that it's flooding and it may become destroyed or damaged by water seeping. And there's a canal that was dug actually through the labyrinth 100 years ago, and it could be flooding not only that area but the area around the pyramid Amenhotep to the north of that, which is a mud brick pyramid. But anyway, it's I brought it up in the context of sort of the resistance of the scientific archaeological establishment to publish stuff that could lead to some new directions. If this turns out to be real, then, and there's something even more impressive than the pyramids. Is it older? This could really upset, Egyptology, right?
Egyptology might want it, not want it discovered, not want it excavated.
Yeah. And in fact, the Egyptian government has suppressed the research that was done on this. One paper was published, but then the researchers were barred from doing any further work. And there's others that have published and talked about this, but they don't have any, they can't produce their findings because they were basically, it was work they did for the Egyptian government, and they won't allow the papers to be released to the public. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, he said that it's because that when the dating is earlier than the earliest known Egyptian kingdoms, they don't want that released because it implies that there was somebody else there before the Egyptians. And yeah. I said to him, it doesn't imply that. It implies that the Egyptians were there longer than we thought. And he agrees, right. But the Egyptology community influences Zahi Hawass and the government with this idea because they don't want it. They don't want it. They say, well, if it's that old, then that wasn't you, was it? And that makes the government say, we don't want to dig. Right. And it's actually the opposite. It means that Egyptian civilization was even more extraordinary, so far they're buying they're taking the bait of the Egyptologists, sadly.
But isn't this the tendency of the current civilization? I think there's some argument that could be made. Maybe it's just anecdotal, but that the current civilization sort of they co-opt what came before and they call it their own. It's like
sure they do.
Kevin, makes it his pyramid, but maybe it was there before.
Khufu who did that because there's a lot of evidence that's a fake hieroglyph in there.
Mm. So, I mean, you know, and yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of a worldwide tendency. You know, it's called adaptive reuse. You know, in Rome, they, you know, they build on the roofs of the prior structures that were there. This is actually
Romans built a temple of Jupiter on platform at Baalbek, and they even used those extraordinary huge granite columns that were brought from Aswan, and there are hundreds of them, thousands maybe, that the Romans could not possibly have floated up the Nile or the Egyptians with anything close to any kind of boat we have ever found. And yet they're there all that distance, 900 miles or something, 780 miles, I believe it is. And the Romans used them, but the Romans did not bring them there, you may be sure.
Yeah, you know, people say, you know, you're saying that, like, these structures are 75,000 years old. How could that possibly be? How could they exist that long? They don't actually have to be. As long as you have, as long as you follow this tendency of building over what was there before, you preserve the geometry of the original site footprint. And that's the key idea in Before Atlantis. That's why I'm saying these sites. I'm not saying that Chichen Itza was built 75,000 years ago. I'm saying it's built on stuff that originated from that time. But it's been adaptively reused in the same way the Romans do it. And even in New York City, you know, New York is built on top of an older city. And it's like it happens everywhere. Right.
Well, it happens. Well, in Damascus, you can't go there anymore, but it's on a hill. A lot of it is very hilly, and the hills are if you dig down, you're going to find other layers of Damascus going down and down and down all the way into prehistory, and that is true all over the world.
That's right.
And like the Acropolis was definitely built by the classical Athenians. The Parthenon. We even know the architect who built it. But that doesn't mean that that was the first structure there by any means.
Exactly. No. Exactly. And so, you know, when you can't explain the alignment using conventional models, and again, this is the second element in Before Atlantis hypothesis, is that, well, okay, if you preserve the site footprint, the geometry, then this is something that may have been aligned with the different frame of reference, frame of reference is a different set of poles. And so that's kind of full circle comes to how this hypothesis basically works. So you don't have to buy that these things aren't, you know, that old. I mean, I would never argue that, you know, these structures are, you know, were built that long, but simply that they've been reused for a very long period of time. And we're a lot older than we think we are. Or humanity is a lot older than we are.
Well, I think we might be. You know, I am the sort of person who never would have believed that. But knowing Graham as long as I have and as well as I have, and knowing the quality of your work and I've read many of your papers. And incidentally, folks, he and Brian O'Leary published a paper in the IEEE Journal about the Mars Face, which is a prestigious scientific journal, and they got that paper in on the sheer brilliance of their research. And it was not something that you would normally have seen in a journal like that. I thought it was a triumph. So I'm very impressed with your work.
We were lucky the editor was somewhat open-minded. Because the letter I got was like, this is not normally something we publish, but, you know, your data, they are intrigued by the data. I wish more scientific journals were like that.
I know. In fact, any time a new data set comes in, they're not intrigued. They're the opposite. They don't want anything to do with it. Right. I see that all the time.
Right.
I am a living new data set in some respects because of some weird things in my brain, but only a few people are interested in that and interested in studying it. Let's talk a little bit about, I want to circle back to the present because I'm seeing this sense of upheaval here. The magnetic pole is not stable, and ice is melting much faster than we had anticipated even 5 years ago. And I just, you know, the result of this is this mice melt, folks, is that the weight of the water goes toward the equator from the poles. And that is going to destabilize the planet. It's got to, eventually, at some point. And we talked about it earlier, and so maybe thousands of years. But what if it's not? Is there any way to, would there be any, let me ask you this. This is, I guess, the question I'm trying to get to. Would there be any warning signs, or would it simply happen abruptly, or can you tell?
Well, I think a key idea in crustal displacement is that there are sort of what you might call nonlinear effects. You know, the linear stuff is what happens over long periods of time, slowly, but nonlinear things happen suddenly. And I believe that was what was behind crustal displacement. It was a sudden event that occurred. The field collapsed, the crust became unlocked, and things started moving, and then stopped as quickly as it started when the field went back again. I don't know if you remember The Day After Tomorrow, that Doomsday movie from, I don't know, was it 10, 20 years ago, where...
Yeah, it was based on one of my books, so I remember it fairly well.
Yeah, I mean, that was a huge nonlinear effect. Now we're locked into this climate cycle. And it's kind of interesting. We have this now in the Northeast. We've been in a drought for like 2+ months. It's hardly rained at all. And it's interesting how, you know, things sort of set up this way. I asked a friend, well, could something like this explain, you know, the ice age, you know, return to the ice ages? And he didn't think so. He didn't think it was, you know, big enough sort of effect. In other words, that climate in itself isn't going to do it. It had to be something else. So I think, again, circling back, it's something that's nonlinear, something that isn't actually predicted, something that's sort of a little bit sort of coming from out there. In the case of, some things, it's an asteroid, right, that hits the Earth. Or it's a solar flare. You're talking about the space weather. Suddenly something happens. That's a nonlinear effect. That change that totally upsets the apple cart. And that's, you can't predict those things. So, I don't have a prediction.
I wish you did.
I know.
But I don't either. But
I don't want to know. I don't want to know.
Well, I don't know if I want to know or not. People always ask me, well, what about the visitors? Won't they tell you? And my impression is they don't necessarily know the future, but they did say one thing about this, and unfortunately it's maddening. They said to me, it will come upon them unawares. In other words, we won't know it before it comes. And that gets me to these sudden changes, that what is going to happen, the big things that are going to happen here are going to be very sudden. And I just wonder if it won't be a crustal shift.
Yeah, I mean, it'll at that point, it'll be academic.
Well, it will. That's right. It'll be academic, but you are an academic, so.
No, I'm not. I'm definitely not an academic.
You're a scientist.
Maybe intellectual, but I know academics, and they play by the rules, and they're, you know, I don't do any of that.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've come to pretty much to the end of our time together, Mark. Are you working on anything now?
Yeah, so I have an interest in showing connections between sort of modern science and the ancient Vedic texts. I have a paper that was accepted for publication in the Journal of Scientific Exploration for sometime next year. And it's a paper that shows connections between yuga cycles and climate cycles on Earth. Mm-hmm. Because I think there's, you know, some underlying truth in, you know, well, certainly in the flood myths, and they're also prevalent in, you know, in the Hindu, you know, stories of, you know, the Mahabharata, you know, the flooding the flooding of Dwarka.
Congratulations.
I got so many things floating around in my head. It's like, I know it's out there somewhere, but, you know, I know Graham Hancock, did a lot of research along the Indian coast. He found a lot of evidence of things that were flooded. And, you know, the period this could have happened is very consistent with the rising of, global sea levels following the end of the ice age. So these dates then could be used in principle to calibrate when during the Dwarka, Krishna was the avatar of Vishnu at that time, and before that it was Rama during the Ramayana, and so mm-hmm. global sea levels you can calibrate, you know, this was maybe, you know, I forget the dates that I came up with. But anyway, there seemed to be a connection between these and then even more ancient timelines that are correlated with sea level changes and climate cycles that are actually detectable in the data. So in other words, if you take the data, the sea level data, and you do spectral analysis, you'll actually get peaks at around 12,000 years, and also around 25,000 years, which is the period of precessional motion. And so anyway, so this is kind of what I'm interested in now, because I think there's some underlying, these are not just stories and fables, there's some underlying basis of fact in these stories and in Vedic science, which is, you know, extremely advanced and precise. So that's kind of what I'm interested in.
Tell us a little bit more about Vedic science.
Well, you know, it's based on the idea of one idea is, you know, is the you know, period in which they measure time. In fact, you know, they have very precise measures of time that go from, you know, nanoseconds, I think, maybe even finer than that. So millions, billions of seconds to like the lifetime of Brahma, which is like 432 billion years, or no, 4.32 trillion years. Again, this is why I wasn't great in school. I couldn't remember my dates, but anyway, I write them down. I don't have them here, but the point is that there are these time scales, and the key one is sort of the Mahayuga, which is 4.32 million years. This is the basis of Indian astronomy. They measure the number of rotations that the Earth, the Moon, Mars, revolutions, I should say, that take place in one Mahayuga. So this is like a yardstick they used for celestial observation, and it's very precise. The values that they came up with thousands of years ago were very, you know, relatively accurate. So you have some basis of precision, and then sort of begs the question: well, where did this come from? Was it purely observational, or was it some older knowledge? You know, the Babylonians had a working knowledge of the planets. I remember doing some research, and there were even older, what we'll call procedure texts that the Sumerians had that were actually more precise than the Babylonian observations, which suggested that there was even earlier knowledge that was, again, you know, like in Egypt, you had earlier structures more sophisticated than later structures. It was like earlier knowledge in this part of the world was more advanced than later knowledge.
Which so again, means something collapsed. It has to mean
something,
that.
Something collapsed. That's right. We're in a state of decline. So a decline from what? So.
Well, that's, of course, we're going to leave you folks with that question. A decline from what? Before we go, I want to read out a list of Mark's books. And this is, you're going to be very interested in Mark Carlotto. Before Atlantis, New Evidence, The Sidonia Controversy, The Mars Enigmas, The Sellers Speak. You know, I'm very interested in these sellers because there are a lot of them are quite near where my old cabin was. Can you tell us just a little bit about The Sellers Speak?
Where I live in Gloucester, and it's Gloucester, Massachusetts. And when I moved here, I didn't know it at the time, but I lived at the edge of a abandoned colonial settlement. And it was called, it's now called Dogtown, but it used to be, it was one of the earliest settlements, you know, early 1600s. And I became fascinated, and I did a lot of mapping, a lot of hiking and mapping, and what's left are the cellars of the old homes that existed there. All the wood and everything has been, you know, was taken away. And so you have, you know, a couple thousand acres, and you have these old roads and stone walls and root cellars in the ground. And it's, you know, it's in my backyard. It's kind of a magical place. So I spent about 10 years after the Mars work. I kind of burned out on that.
It's understandable.
I had to get away from it. So I went from Mars and UFO research to local archaeology. And I wrote 3 books about that here in Gloucester.
And then there's Beyond Atlantis, Vestiges of the Last Civilization. And then Not of This World, about UFOs. So it's a very eclectic group of books, and they're all brilliantly written and well worked out. And talk about alternative. You get about as alternative as you can get. And so it's quite fascinating stuff, and it's ideal material for Dreamland. In many ways, I hope you're both right and wrong. I hope you're right about our past and wrong about these sudden changes, which could happen to us probably any time. Mark, thank you so much for being with us.
You're very kind, Whitley. It's been a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.